This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I think this is the piece of prostate cancer journey that generally gets very little discussion in a lot of kind of seminars like this, and even in the clinic where you're really, you know, a lot of discussions are focused on which is the right hormone therapy, which is the right chemotherapy, how to treat localized disease. And we sort of forget about the bones. And I see it a lot. And I think that we can do better. Let's see if I can go here. So I broke this up into just some sort of basic questions. You know, what do we know about bone health? What is osteopenia? What is osteoporosis? We throw these terms around a lot. How does prostate cancer specifically affect the bones? And then what can we do to keep them healthy? And I'll walk through some of the data. And I think there is some controversy here about, and that was brought up earlier, about vitamin D, about calcium. And I'll give you my two cents, but I don't think we're going to resolve that today, as much as we might try. So the bones have really two major functions. The first one is just structural, right? The bones support us. And that's what we call the bone matrix. That's the hard part of the bone. The other function is that actually bones host the bone marrow. And if anyone's ever had ossobuco in a restaurant, you know what that is. That's the marrow inside the bone. It's actually quite tasty, at least when it's, you know, when it's in a good Italian restaurant. But it's where all the, basically where all the elements of our blood come from. The white cells, the red cells, the platelets are all born in the marrow, leave the marrow and spread around the body. And that is important because later on in advanced prostate cancer, in men who've had a lot of therapy, for example, radiation therapy, maybe to the prostate and pelvis, maybe they've had chemotherapy, maybe they've had radiation to spots in the spine or other things like that. Those each damage the bone marrow. And then the cancer itself can get inside the marrow, right? The cancer can go to the bone. That's one of the most common places that prostate cancer spreads to. So if you have cancer in the bone, you've damaged the bone in about, you know, three or four different ways. Sometimes in advanced prostate cancer, people have a lot of trouble. They have anemia, low blood counts. They can get low white cell counts. And sometimes that can really limit our therapies. And I think this also is not generally discussed early on for men who have, you know, localized prostate cancer, to think about sort of the functions of the bone and the marrow. And I will say the marrow is concentrated in the large bones, so the square-looking bones. That means our vertebrae, our pelvis, and our femurs. You know, prostate cancer also spreads to those bones, and that's because they're very vascular. They have lots of blood flow, whereas the small bones, like in our hands or in our feet, have almost no blood flow in them. There's no marrow there. And so you don't generally see prostate metastases to those bones. It's generally the center part of the body where you see that. So it's just sort of important to keep in mind as we think about bone health. The bones are, this is sort of a big common misconception. We think of bones as being sort of a dead, you know, sort of inert organ, but they're actually alive. And this is a cutaway of what a bone looks like under a microscope. If you take a section of bone and bone marrow, and you have really three types of cells in there. The first ones are the osteoblasts. Blast is to create. And these are the cells that actually lay down new bone. So for example, if you start lifting weights and you're putting a lot of stress on the bones, there'll be signals to these cells to lay down more bone to support you better. If you break a bone, there'll be signals to lay down new bone to help bridge the break. And that's what these osteoblasts do. And they're labeled here. You can see them sort of right on the edge of the bone, kind of laying down bone on top of already existing bone. Their antagonists, you know, sort of a yin-yang here, are the osteoclasts. And these are cells that actually break down bone. And you might say, wait, why do we have cells that chew up our own bones? What's that about? And it's really to help with remodeling. So if you do some activity that's, you know, repetitive and your bones are not in the right shape, you actually may need to sort of reduce the bones or change the dynamics of the bone. And that's what these big cells, these osteoclasts do. They just get in and start eating up bone. And then you have these osteocytes, which are the little guys that are actually, they actually get embedded in the bone. They're sort of like osteoblasts that essentially have gotten trapped. And they still have function. They secrete certain hormones. They help with sort of regulation of the bone, calcium, vitamin D, and other things. So they're still actually working, even though they're sort of surrounded by, you know, this inorganic bone. What I like to think is, if you think about the bones, in order to change the bones, you often have to tear things down before you can build things up. And this is a constant process happening in all of us right now. And if any of you remember from the Mercury missions and the Apollo missions in space in the 60s, no one thought about bone health for these astronauts. And they basically went up to space, spent 5 or 6 days, and came back down to Earth. And because they were in zero gravity for 5 days in a row, there was no pressure on the bones. And actually, when they got back down to Earth, their muscles had weakened, their bones had thinned out. And it's like a major problem for NASA, because they're like strapping young guys who suddenly were like kittens when they got back to Earth. And so if you look at all these astronauts now, they go up to space, they have to exercise every day and actually do like resistance bands, and they do all these different exercises to keep the bones healthy, even though there's no stress on them. In fact, precisely because there's no stress on the bone. So I just think that's an important sort of concept. So what happens in us? What goes on with osteoporosis, osteopenia? And this is, I think, just a nice picture showing the difference between healthy bone on the left, osteopenia, which means literally it's Greek for low bone or less bone, and then osteoporosis, which is the same word in English, which means porous bone. And it's just a spectrum of bone loss. And what you see is there's progressively loss of calcium, but the bone is actually a matrix. You know, it's this sort of reinforced kind of like structure. So there's a lot of ability for the bone to survive stress. And what happens is, as you lose bone, you start losing these connections between different parts of the bone. And by the time you have osteoporosis, the bone's very weak and it's at more risk for fracture. And that's very clear that people who have osteoporosis are going to be at a higher risk for fracture. So even in somebody who doesn't have bone metastases, it's important to screen for osteoporosis. And I'll tell you how we do that, because people are at risk for this even without prostate cancer. And then, as I mentioned, prostate cancer metastasizes to bone and can cause lots of trouble. So it's important to get ahead of this. So what causes actual bone loss? How do you get osteoporosis or osteopenia? There's a number of environmental things that damage the bone. Cigarette smoking is a big one. So people who are long-term smokers have a much higher risk of developing loss of the bone. Really, any inflammation, chronic inflammation in the body can do it. So that's over here. If you look at folks who have like Crohn's disease, celiac disease, any of these autoimmune diseases are actually at higher risk of bone loss. Sedentary lifestyles, because you're not really using, you know, your bones. It's like the astronauts I just mentioned. Seems like diets that are low in calcium and D may put people at slightly higher risk, but that's where there's some controversy, because it's not necessarily recommended that everybody in the world take calcium and D supplements, but you do need to have a sort of minimum amount in your diet. It does seem to run in families. And then there's other specific, more specific diseases. There are glands called the parathyroids, which sit on our thyroid gland that regulate calcium and vitamin D in our body. Folks who've used high doses of steroids, this is not just 5 milligrams of prednisone, but people who are on 60 milligrams of prednisone or equivalents get loss of bone. And then probably the most important thing, for especially for this room, is that testosterone or estrogen lowering therapies reduce bone health. Testosterone is good for the bones. And if I don't have I usually have a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger here from 1970 or something, when he was like built. And that's because he was taking tons of extra testosterone to get that big, and his bones were thick and strong and healthy. So when we give people Lupron or remove testosterone from the body, we end up doing the opposite. And that's why the bones get weak. So why is that a problem? I think this is going to be pretty obvious to this audience, but osteoporosis is bad because of fractures. So a hip fracture can happen at any point in the bone here, but wherever this happens, it's bad. You can also get vertebral fractures, which sometimes aren't as well noted. Some people don't have pain with a vertebral fracture, but you know, as we get older, if you get more and more vertebral fractures, you can end up getting more and more hunched. And that's when you see someone who's really hunched over, that's because their bones are just getting progressively compressed in the spine from these fractures. Sometimes they're painful. They clearly cause debilitation. And so surgery may be needed, long recovery. It can be a big challenge. Hip fracture is particularly bad. This is a picture I meant to show of what the vertebral fracture looks like. So here's the vertebrae. It's usually on the side of the vertebrae that's on the called ventral or front facing side of the vertebrae. And here you can see this bone has just completely collapsed in on itself. Instead of being like a nice square, it's now this sort of wedge shape, and that's called a compression fracture. So we really want to avoid that because there's not an easy way to fix that. You can sometimes inject some cement in there to stabilize it, but it never returns the bone back to its full height. Hip fractures are really, really bad. And I think people know that it's bad because, oh my God, you got to go to the hospital, you have to get a surgery. But these are actually outcomes based on thousands of patient experience, you know, thousands of patients who've had one. And I just want to read through them. So 50% of people who have one fracture will have another one. So you're at high risk. If you get one hip fracture, you're at big risk for getting another one. 33% in the following year will end up in a nursing home. 40% won't be able to walk independently. You might need a cane or a walker. 60% still require some assistance a year later. And this is the one that I think doesn't get very recognized. In the first year after a hip fracture, about 1 in 4 people won't survive the first year after a hip fracture. So it's really devastating. People say, why? It's just a bone. It can't be that bad. But when you get a hip fracture, you end up in the hospital. You're usually laid out for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, completely flat. And then, you know, bad things happen in the hospital. People get pneumonia. People get, it's a stress on the body. They get atrial fibrillation. They get other, you know, heart attacks and strokes, and they have to go through major surgery. And so there's just a lot of things that happen all at once. And it's not even just the time in the hospital. It's then being in a rehab and everything else that really, really causes lots of problems. So we try and avoid these, understandably, as much as possible. So coming back to like what we can do, first of all, we measure bone density using this test called the DEXA, D-X-A, dual X-ray absorptometry, I think is the word. And it's always been complex to me. And I don't know if you guys feel the same way. I always have trouble reading these reports. And I'm sure as a patient who doesn't have a medical background, it's even harder. They report two scores, the T-score and the Z-score. And these are comparisons either to young, sort of healthy sex matched controls, so young male or young female, or the Z-score, which is an aged match control. So if you're 65, they try and find a 65-year-old man and say, what's the average and where do you sit? The lower scores are negative, and you can see the scoring system's super weird because it's like if you're greater than -1, you're fine. But if you're between -1 and -2.5, that's osteopenia. And if you're below -2.5, osteoporosis. So it's not so important that you know how this works. It's just the way it's done. But essentially, it's an X-ray of the hips, pelvis. Sometimes they do the wrist. Sometimes they can do other bones in the body. And it's the best way to get a sense of bone density. The one caveat here is that if there's prostate cancer in the bone, it totally messes up the test. And so patients who have especially a lot of bony metastases should not be getting DEXA scans because actually they falsely are reassuring. If you do a DEXA scan and someone has a lot of bone metastases, it comes out like +6, you know, and you're like, oh, my bones are great, right? But they're not great. It's just the prostate cancer interfering with the test. So it's just not a helpful test. I get a lot of questions about blood-based tests for osteoporosis, and I put all these here. I'm not going to walk through them all, but you can see there's like 8 or 10 different blood-based tests, and all of these are breakdown products of bone, of collagen, of other structures in the bone, and you can detect them in the blood. Problem is that they haven't really panned out as a good screening test. They vary between individuals, so they're used in some trials, but they're not the perfect test. So like basically all the major guidelines don't recommend using these, and I don't use them. I don't know if you guys use them at all. Yeah. So everyone's head shaking. It's just, I wish it were easier because the DEXA is kind of a hassle to do, although it's just an X-ray. It's not the end of the world. These would be easier, but I think we have more work to do here. So what does prostate cancer do to the bone? I'm going to try and wrap up here. This is what we see on an X-ray in a patient with very advanced prostate cancer. And this is the pelvis. The bone should all look like this kind of white color. And what you're seeing here are these huge areas that are just eaten up. And it looks almost like, if you ever left like a moth eating a sweater in a closet, that's what the bones look like when the cancer is really out of control. And this is the type of technology now where we can actually create 3D images. And you can just see how totally destroyed the bones are in this patient. This is probably the worst I've ever seen, but I show it to you just to say this is what prostate cancer can do, in that it hones in on the bone, it makes space for itself, some evidence it can secrete acids and things like that that dissolve the bone. And probably what it's doing is activating those osteoclasts, which I told you chew up bone. And so there's this whole sort of inflammatory milieu in the bone that's really bad. And it causes so much trouble. And this could be a patient without osteoporosis. This could be a patient who had previously normal bone density and then had really bad cancer in the bone. So we have to be very sort of thoughtful about this. Again, this is a busy slide, and I don't want to dive too deep into this, but just to say that there are a lot of different sort of molecular factors at play. Some of them stimulate on the left at the bottom here, an osteolytic or breakdown of bone. Some of them stimulate a laying down of bone. It's like a push and pull between the two. At the end of the day, they all cause sort of the same effect, which is to destabilize the bone. I highlight this one called the RANK ligand system because we have a drug that targets that, and I'll get to that in just a sec, and also want to be conscious of the time here. So what do our treatments do to the bone? Well, so low testosterone, I already told you, is bad for the bones, and these are the numbers. Patients who are on hormone therapy like Leuprolide or others have just a 21% increased risk of any fracture. That's regardless of whether or not they have osteoporosis. A hip fracture is 30% increased, and vertebral fracture is 45% increased. And then, as I mentioned earlier, other things damage the bone. Radiation therapy can cause weakening of the bone. Chemotherapy, there's some evidence it can do that. I don't think we know enough about the radioligand therapy you just heard Dr. Dekuchowski talk about, but that's a radioactive element that's honing in typically on bone metastases. So it's probably not strengthening the bones, right? It might be weakening them. And then diets can often be challenging, especially in people with very advanced disease. So they're probably not getting enough nutrients. So this is probably the most controversial slide, although you think it would be the least controversial, right? Which is, what can we do? So diet and exercise are like, you know, I put this in every one of my notes at the end. And there are a couple of folks here who I see in clinic, and I'm sure they know at the end, it says diet, exercise, like 7 exclamation points, because it's really important. You heard Dr. Chan and Dr. Kenfield talking about that a little while ago. Different societies have different levels of calcium and vitamin D that are recommended. Most societies actually recommend more than 400, like 600 to 800 units of vitamin D. You can get some of this from your diet, and it's actually recommended. The vitamin D basically helps our bodies absorb calcium in our gut. If you don't have vitamin D, then you're not going to be able to absorb the calcium. And back in the day, you know, there was a disease called rickets, which you know, children got where they were really malnourished, especially in northern climates where they just didn't have a lot of vitamin D in their diet. You can get it from dairy. That's probably the principal source, and nuts. And then some other foods, healthy foods, lentils, salmon, leafy greens. The one thing I'm going to point out, though, is that this is this is almond milk, which is vitamin D fortified. And one glass of almond milk has 10% of your recommended daily dose of vitamin D. So you actually have to drink a lot of almond milk to do this. And so I think for anyone who's on hormone therapy, it's very hard to just do this with your diet. I didn't have a slide about checking vitamin D levels, but that's incredibly important. We do that in just about everybody. People who are low should get supplemented. There's not really good evidence that going way beyond, you know, 30 or 40 units of vitamin D or on your vitamin D measure, that there's like hypervitamin D is probably not that helpful. And there's a lot of debate about this in people who are otherwise healthy, is do you need calcium and vitamin D? I recommend it for everyone. It's pretty easy to do. And there's pretty good evidence, certainly in people who have osteopenia and osteoporosis, that it's helpful. But, you know, when you're taking dairy, when you're looking, just take a look at how much vitamin D is in here. And calcium here is only 8% in a glass of almond milk. So you really need a lot of this stuff orally to get through. I just want to shout out again to Dr. Kenfield, Dr. Van Blarigan, Dr. Chan for doing a lot of the work here about diet and exercise. You heard about that a little while ago. Last thing I want to say before I end is that we do have therapies that are stronger than calcium and vitamin D, and there's two major ones. The first one are called bisphosphonates. Zoledronic acid is probably the best known of these. And basically, this is like a sort of modified form of phosphate. Our bones are made of calcium and phosphate. That's what our bones are. And this is like a sort of a decoy phosphate. And what it does is it gets in the bones and it really stops the osteoclast from tearing down bone. So it integrates into the bone, and then it sort of favors bone deposition instead of bone resorption, and it's approved for osteoporosis. And actually, Eric led the major trial that showed that this was beneficial at the time of CRPC, or at the time of resistance to testosterone-lowering therapy. And more recently, about 10, 15 years ago, we had a new drug that's called denosumab, which is an injected RANK ligand inhibitor, and basically does a very similar activity. The nice thing about denosumab is it's just a subcutaneous injection as opposed to an IV infusion, which is what the bisphosphonates, the zoledronic acid is, and then the calcium and vitamin D as I've recommended. So just to wrap up, diet and weight-bearing exercise are key, and I should have put more exclamation points on there because it really is. Monitoring, the DEXA scans are approved by Medicare every 2 years for folks who don't have bone metastases. Following the vitamin D levels is really important. Calcium and probably more vitamin D than I even listed on the slide is recommended. And then if there's MCRPC or if there's osteoporosis, then you should talk to your doc, either your medical oncologist or an endocrinologist or your primary care, about being on one of these stronger bone meds, because they definitely prevent fractures in folks who take them. So I'll stop there. So thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.